So I'm just going to give a bit of an overview of the retreat, as much as I can do right now, given that we don't have the complete overview. But it'll be enough. It'll be enough. And I thought I'd just start with a reading from The Cave in the Snow. And this is Tenzin Palmo talking about, talking a bit about metta and talking about why one goes on retreat. This is what she's describing. So she says, one goes into retreat to understand who one really is and what the situation truly is. When one begins to understand oneself, then one can truly understand others, because we're all interrelated. It is very difficult to understand others while one is still caught up in the turmoil of one's emotional involvement, because we're always interpreting others from the standpoint of our own needs. That's why when you meet hermits who have really done a lot of retreat, say 25 years, they are not cold and distant. On the contrary, they're absolutely lovely people. You know that their love for you is totally without judgment because it doesn't rely on who you are or what you're doing or how you treat them. It's totally impartial. It's just love. It's like the sun. It shines on everyone. Whatever you did, they still love you because they understand your predicament. And in that understanding, compassion naturally arises. Love naturally arises. It's not based on sentiment. It's not based on emotion. Sentimental love is very unstable because it's based on feedback and how good it makes you feel. That is not real love at all. Yeah. And then I was also thinking about that fantastic story about Angulimala and the Buddha, which you probably all know very well. So the Buddha wants to go into the forest, or he wants to walk along a certain path, doesn't he, along a certain track. And the villagers all say to him, don't go down that track. There's a bandit on that track, and he kills people. It's not a good idea to use that track. And the Buddha said, I can do this. He sort of said that in a sort of Pali canon sort of way. And anyway, he goes down that track completely confident about what he's going to meet and how he's going to deal with it. And he meets this bandit called Angulimala, who's got this necklace of fingers around his neck. And every time he's killed somebody, he cuts the finger off and places it around his neck as a necklace. And anyway, so he's walking along at the normal pace, and and Angulimala cannot catch up with him. And Angulimala's running as fast as he can, but he still cannot catch up with him, which is a very interesting metaphor, actually. It's sort of like, in a way, I think metta cannot be caught up with on it, you know, if you're not on its level, kind of thing, you know. If you're still playing games, you cannot approach metta. You cannot, in a way, you can't kind of catch up with the people that do have metta. It's all right, don't worry. And anyway, Angulimala shouts, stop, stop. And what does the Buddha reply? I have stopped. Yeah, I have stopped. It's you that hasn't stopped. And Angulimala does challenge him a bit on his practice of honesty at this moment. He does say, how is it that when I can hardly catch up with you, you say that that you have stopped, and then when I stop, you say it's me that hasn't stopped, you know? So have a little interchange like that. And the Buddha says, I have stopped I've stopped acting with violence towards other beings, and you haven't stopped that. That's the teaching that he gives him. And then in the book, when I was reading it, It said, and at that moment, I mean, let's see if I can find it actually, because it's very beautiful. I can't find it. So many different talks. Oh, yes, here we go. He says, at that moment, when Angulimala heard those words, a great change of heart came over him. He felt as if the current of his suppressed, nobler and purer urges had broken through the dam of hardened cruelty that had been built up through habituation in all those years of his life. So he felt that something had been touched that hadn't been touched for an awful long time. And it hadn't been touched because there'd been layer upon layer upon layer of habit that had kind of defended that soft spot, if you like, defended that place where he could be touched. And it's very interesting to see what needs to stop for us to touch that place where non-violence does not happen, where metta naturally happens. What needs to stop? There's this really fabulous DVD available, which I think might be called The Dharma Brothers, I think. Do people know, is it called The Dharma Brothers? Yeah. Which is when there's a Vipassana retreat set up in the middle of a high security prison in the middle of America. And so it's a film of that retreat, but they have to interlay it with various kind of autobiographical pieces of footage and also stories of those guys coming out of retreat. Partly because a film of a 12-day Vipassana retreat doesn't have a lot of action to it. So they have to do this really technically, you know. But there's this very, really beautiful moment. Well, there's a number of beautiful moments in that, heart-rendering stories. And they go through, those guys, like Angulimala, go through one layer after another, revealing different levels of emotional sensitivity and revealing aspects of their life. You know, I think one of the guys says day five was hard in comparison to 12 years on death row kind of thing. And you can only slightly imagine what they were facing in themselves. And one of the guys, I found really moving, one of the guys said, he said he didn't know what's going to arise in that retreat. But what arose was, before he'd committed the murder, they were all murderers, before he'd committed the murder, he was in, he'd gone to pick up his young daughter from school. And the daughter was maybe about 4 years old. And while he was there, she ran across the playground. She was playing and she ran across the playground and she fell and she cracked her head and she died in his arms. And he just talks about that and he said, I never knew I would feel that again. That's what he was talking about. It's like all these layers of habitual thinking processes and ways of being overlaid that, and what he felt on day five was that moment in the car park where he lifted his little daughter, carried her, and then she died in his arms. And just the grief and the sadness and everything he was feeling right then, that's what he felt. Yeah. So what does it look like to just continually let go of all those habits of thought, habits of clinging, habits of ignoring, you know, habits of blame that take us away from what's actually happening, so that when we actually arrive at what's actually happening, we start moving towards who we really are. And when we do that, of course, we can then move towards other people and allow them to be who they really are, whatever way that is. Okay, obviously not going to be using notes today. okay, let's do something else. So on this retreat, we're going to have a whole thread of prachitta samuppada, of dependent arising. We're just going to be looking at that in our experience over and over again. And we're going to be looking at how those layers of habit get built up, and then how do we stand free from them so that the real metta will come through. So what supports metta to come through? You know, what releases us from some of those habits that block the metta, obstruct the metta? So this is what we're going to be doing. And we're going to be doing that. We're just going to be seeing how metta can arise through that quality, that process of dependent arising. It can arise. We can develop metta, so we can see that happening in ourselves. We can see that volition. That's a volition. It's not a vedana. It's a volition. That desire for people to be well, people to be happy. It's not pleasant sensations. It's not sentiment. So this retreat may or may not include pleasant sensations for you. That's a shame, isn't it? But it might. It might. But what it will include is a great turning of heart, turning, where we're able to approach things that we don't want to approach. We're able to turn towards those things that are hard to turn towards, because we'll begin to see them more as dependent arising and less as she did that to me, I did that to me, it's her fault that that's happening. It's going to release all of those, hopefully. And we'll begin to see ourselves as arising out of conditions. And who we've become has been constructed out of conditions. We're going to see that a bit more through just watching our experience. So if you think of metta as being something which can be supported, yeah? What are the conditions that can support metta? So there could be a few things, and we're going to be playing around with different things, but what are the things that we need to support metta in our life? So we need a relaxed mind, a sky-like mind. I used to go out with this guy when I was living in Glasgow, and he was very kind to me sometimes, and he would put his hand on my head and say, "Relax the brain." And it was very good instruction for me, because my mind was often not very relaxed, and I would have all sorts of thoughts going on. And Kulanandi once said to me, "Rachel, you have the brain and the mind to go round corners." I don't know what that meant. I think that meant I could go a long way on very little, and I could go round corners with my mind processes. And anyway, I had a kind boyfriend who used to say, "Relax the mind." And a relaxed mind is a mind that can respond more easily with metta. It's a more open mind, a quality of openness and a kind of spacious mind. There's a bit less clinging, a bit less resistance to experience, a bit less hatred or aversion. And then a clear mind is a mind that supports metta. Clarity supports metta. It's very interesting when when you're struggling with other people, you could think it through. You know, what is the problem here? You know, where is the difficulty showing up? What is the intensity? Metta has a lot of clarity. I think we tend to think metta is a bit clouded because it's sentimental and it's got a soft focus. It hasn't got a soft focus, it's got a very sharp focus. Really sees people clearly. One of the qualities of metta is it has a really good eye for detail. Yeah. So clarity, clarity not just about what's going on, not just about the situation, but a clarity of the Dharma. What is the dharmic context for this particular situation? What is right for you right now? We need to have this at our fingertips, basically. We need to have right view at our fingertips. We need to be able to contextualize our experience within right view. We need to see what is actually happening in our experience. We need to see that maybe suffering is arising, dukkha is arising. We need to see ourselves in terms of the skandhas, see ourselves as dependent arising, processes, see the other as dependent arising, see other as being factors conditioning their behaviour. Yeah, in the Bodhicaryavatara, Shantideva goes on about this quite a lot, all of this stuff. And he's got a very lovely lovely approach to collective practice. He does the kind of direct pointing of seeing through self in relationship to other people and your relationship to others. I suspect it's because he was living in a monastery, and that's where the self arises a lot in relationship to other people. And he was probably seeing that quite a bit. So he says, he leads us through a lot of reflections around conditionality. And let me see if I can find some of those verses, actually. He says, it's mostly in the chapter on patience. He says, in this way, everything is dependent upon something else. Even that thing upon which each is dependent is not independent. Since, like a magical display, phenomena do not initiate activity, at what does one get angry like this with? In other words, how are you getting angry? It's just a load of conditions coming together. And then you'll argue, yes, but that set of conditions over there has got a consciousness. It should know what it's doing. And he says, let's see if I can find it. Whether the cause possesses consciousness or not, dukkha is inevitable for embodied beings. That dukkha appears in what is conscious. Tolerate that pain, therefore. He also says, you feel no anger towards bile. I don't know why. It was a sort of medieval thing about bile. Anyway, you feel no anger towards bile and the like, even though they cause intense suffering. So why are you angry with the sentient? They too have reasons for their anger. So in other words, bile is created. It's just dependent arising. It's just arising out of conditions. And the anger, the actions the person's doing is just arising out of conditions. So why are you getting angry at them? It's just another play of phenomena. Anyway, he tries to work out everything you're trying to, all your little loopholes, you know. Actually, this is another little interesting loophole. Where is it? He says, obviously, then he's met with a different argument. He says, okay, if everything is just dependent arising, then I don't have to feel metta for it, do I? It doesn't have to make any difference, does it? Whether I get angry or not, or feel metta or not, makes no difference. Just a load of play of conditionality. And he says, no, since there is dependent origination, there can be cessation of suffering. So in other words, since everything is being conditioned by everything else, your metta will change the conditions, thereby change them. Anyway, I love him. I love the way he plays around with all of this so much. It's a very interesting chapter. When I was looking up Banti's teachings on patience, and I was looking in the survey, I found this little nugget, gorgeous. He says, patience is not the ability to withstand pain that gets stronger and stronger. In other words, it's not just forbearance. So patience is not just the ability to withstand pain that gets stronger and stronger. It's the thing that we perceive as getting hurt that gets weaker and weaker. Or I think you might say, it's the clinging that we have to the thing that we perceive as being hurt gets weaker and weaker. Very nice, isn't it? Where he's again playing around with that. When we're practicing patience, we can easily think it's that we're getting stiffer, and this is us being able to sort of withstand conditions. But he's saying it's not that. Something else is getting weaker. And it's that, it's our desire to need to sort of stand up to something. Kind of, it's the arising of self that's softening that allows us to have patience. Yeah, so we're going to be looking a bit at right view and all of that. And then there's this quality of sensitivity or receptivity, empathy. There was a point, I think, in the body scan that we've just done where Diyajyoti was talking about the kind of life that we feel in us. I was phasing in and out a bit. She gave me permission to do that. And but it was a lovely moment where I was just tuning in with just all the sensations of my experience and the life within me. And it's like that quality of sensitivity in us, that we are alive and other beings are alive. So just tuning in with that sensitivity in us and tuning in with the sensitivity of others and with nature. We're going to be surrounded by nature while we're here on retreat. We can sit in the garden or we can look out the window. You could just go out there and just be surrounded by life and just allow it to sort of, just be looked at by nature. Just be in relation to nature. When we lose that quality of sensitivity, we lose that quality of relationship. So just feel yourself as a living being who's just in relationship to others, other conditions. Just be in relationship, feel that relationship. Sitting at the table, eating your lunch, feel those relationships, feel that sensitivity between us. Be looked at by the blackbird. Just be looked at by the blackbird. Yeah. So we're going to be just having short teaching sessions. Some days during the retreat at 10:30. And we're going to try and do enough input to give you something to do and enough space to then do something with it. Yeah? And that's the sort of ebb and flow of the retreat. And tomorrow I'm going to be doing a little short talk on turning towards. And we're going to look at turning towards as a way of responding to experience with non-craving, non-aversion, and non-delusion. And then the next day, Diyajyoti is going to be talking a bit about, I haven't got my program in front of me, metta, yes, as dependent arising, and exploring just how metta arises out of conditions, and we'll be looking a bit more at the conditions. And then this retreat can be a kind of practical way of you allowing some of those conditions to come into play. So metta rises out of them, rather than you trying to force metta into, you know, force yourself into a particular kind of metaful shape. It's going to sort of arise out of those conditions. And then that's going to inform us a bit more in terms of how things, everything is just arising out of those conditions, metta included. I don't know if there's anything else I really need to say. What else do I need to say, Dijoti? No, nothing. You think? Let me see if there's anything else I've got on my notes. When are we going into silence? Sian asks. We haven't talked about it in the team because we generally just no. Yes. The Shantideva verses are mostly in the patience chapter, and Bhante's quote is in a section on patience, and it's quite short. Yep. It varies depending on which version you look at, and I think in the earlier versions of the survey it doesn't exist at all, that quote. I'm not sure, but so okay. Maybe I'll just end with a nice quote from Bhante actually. A common misapprehension is to think of insight and egolessness in abstract, even metaphysical terms, rather than comprising concretely lived attitudes and behaviour. But realising the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. To contemplate the principle of egolessness as some special principle that is somehow separate from our actual behaviour will leave it as far away as ever. If we find it difficult to realise the ultimate emptiness of the self, the solution is to try and be a little less selfish. The understanding comes after the experience and not before. In short, metta and insight are not separate aims. Indeed, metta is a necessary aspect of insight. And with reflection on the real nature of metta, insight will shine through. Having developed metta in a limited sense as an equal kindness towards others, you can go on to reflect on whether there is really any difference between yourself and others, and, if so, what that difference might be. Thus reflecting, you will begin to see that the idea that I am I and she is she is no more than a delusion, and in that way, metta begins to blend with insight. Forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means for you alone, you can go on indefinitely and happily expanding the breadth and depth of your interest and positivity. The self is replaced by a creative orientation of being, or rather, since being is not a very Buddhist term, a creative orientation of becoming. Maybe I'll just let him have the last word. Thank you. Let's leave it there. Thank you.